The logic of suicide terrorism. First you feel nervous about riding the bus. Then you wonder about going to a mall. Then you think twice about sitting for long at your favorite cafe. Then nowhere seems safe. Terrorist groups have a strategy to shrink to nothing the areas in which people move freely, and suicide bombers, inexpensive and reliably lethal, are their latest weapons. Israel has learned to recognize and disrupt the steps on the path to suicide attacks. We must learn to. By Bruce Hoffman. Early everywhere in the world it is taken for granted that one can simply push open the door to a restaurant, cafe, or bar, sit down, and order a meal or a drink. In Israel the process of entering such a place is more complicated. One often encounters an armed guard who, in addition to asking prospective patrons whether they themselves are armed, may quickly pat them down, feeling for the telltale bulge of a belt or a vest containing explosives. Establishments that cannot afford a guard or are unwilling to pass on the cost of one to customers simply keep their doors locked, responding to knocks with a quick glance through the glass and an instant judgment as to whether this or that person can safely be admitted. What would have been unimaginable a year ago is now not only routine, but reassuring. It has become the price of a redefined normality. In the United States in the 20 months since 9/11 we, too, have had to become accustomed to an array of new, often previously inconceivable security measures in airports and other transportation hubs, hotels and office buildings, sports stadiums and concert halls. Although some are more noticeable and perhaps more inconvenient than others, the fact remains that they have redefined our own sense of normality. They are accepted because we feel more vulnerable than before. With every new threat to international security, we become more willing to live with stringent precautions and reflexive, almost unconscious wariness. With every new threat, that is, our everyday life becomes more like Israel's. The situation in Israel, where last year's intensified suicide bombing campaign changed the national mood and people's personal politics, is not analogous to that in the United States today. But the organization and the operations of the suicide bombers are neither limited to Israel and its conflict with the Palestinians, nor unique to its geostrategic position. The fundamental characteristics of suicide bombing and its strong attraction for the terrorist organizations behind it are universal. Suicide bombings are inexpensive and effective. They are less complicated and compromising than other kinds of terrorist operations. They guarantee media coverage. The suicide terrorist is the ultimate smart bomb. Perhaps most important, coldly efficient bombings tear at the fabric of trust that holds societies together. All these reasons doubtless account for the spread of suicide terrorism from the Middle East to Sri Lanka and Turkey, Argentina and Chechnya, Russia and Algeria, and to the United States. To understand the power that suicide terrorism can have over a populace and what a populace can do to counter it, one naturally goes to the society that has been most deeply affected. As a researcher who has studied the strategies of terrorism for more than 25 years, I recently visited Israel to review the steps the military, the police, and the intelligence and security services have taken against a threat more pervasive and personal than ever before. Was looking at X-rays with Dr. Shmuel Shapira in his office at Jerusalem's Hadassah Hospital. "This is not a place to have a wristwatch," he said, as he described the injuries of a young girl who'd been on her way to school one morning last November when a suicide terrorist detonated a bomb on her bus. 11 of her fellow passengers were killed and more than 50 others wounded. The blast was so powerful that the hands and case of the bomber's wristwatch had turned into lethal projectiles, lodging in the girl's neck and ripping a major artery. The presence of such foreign objects in the bodies of his patients no longer surprises Shapira. "We have cases with a nail in the neck, or nuts and bolts in the thigh, a ball bearing in the skull," he said. "Such are the weapons of war in Israel today. Nuts and bolts, screws, and ball bearings, any metal shards, or odd bits of broken machinery that can be packed together with homemade explosive and then strapped to the body of a terrorist dispatched to any place where people gather: bus, train, restaurant, cafe, supermarket, shopping mall, street corner, promenade. These attacks probably cost no more than $150 to mount, and they need no escape plan, often the most difficult aspect of a terrorist operation. And they are reliably deadly. According to data from the RAND Corporation's Chronology of International Terrorism Incidents, suicide attacks, on average, kill 4 times as many people as other terrorist acts. Perhaps it is not surprising, then, that this means of terror has become increasingly popular. The tactic first emerged in Lebanon. In 1983, a decade later it came to Israel, and it has been a regular security problem ever since. Fully 2/3 of all such incidents in Israel have occurred in the past 2.5 years, that is, since the start of the Second Intifada, in September of 2000. Indeed, suicide bombers are responsible for almost half of the approximately 750 deaths in terrorist attacks since then. Last December, I walked through Jerusalem with 2 police officers, one of them a senior operational commander, who were showing me the sites of suicide bombings in recent years. They described the first major suicide terrorist attack in the city, which occurred in February of 1996. Early on a Sunday morning, the beginning of the Israeli work week. The driver of the number 18 egg bus was hurrying across a busy intersection at Sarai Israel Street as a yellow light turned red. The bus was about halfway through when an explosion transformed it into an inferno of twisted metal, pulverized glass, and burning flesh. A traffic camera designed to catch drivers running stoplights captured the scene on film. 25 people were killed, including 2 U.S. citizens, and 80 were wounded. The early years of suicide terrorism were a simpler time, the officers explained. Suicide bombers were at least in theory easier to spot then. They tended to carry their bombs in nylon backpacks or duffel bags rather than in belts or vests concealed beneath their clothing, as they do now. They were also typically male, aged 17 to 23. And unmarried. Armed with these data, the authorities could simply deny work permits to Palestinians most likely to be suicide bombers, thus restricting their ability to cross the Green Line, Israel's pre-1967 border, into Israel proper from the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. Today, though, suicide bombers are middle-aged and young, married and unmarried, and some of them have children. Some of them, too, are women. And word has it that even children are being trained for martyrdom. There is no clear profile anymore, not for terrorists, and especially not for suicide bombers, an exasperated senior officer in the Israel Defense Forces told me last year. Sometimes the bombers disguise themselves. Male Shahid Arabic for martyrs have worn green IDF fatigues, have dressed as Haredim ultra-Orthodox Jews, complete with yarmulkes and tzitzit, the fringes that devout Jews display as part of their everyday clothing, or have donned long haired wigs in an effort to look like hip Israelis rather than threatening Arabs. A few women have tried to camouflage bombs by strapping them to their stomachs to fake pregnancy. And contrary to popular belief, the bombers are not drawn exclusively from the ranks of the poor but have included 2 sons of millionaires. Most of the September 11th terrorists came from comfortable middle to upper middle class families and were well educated. The Israeli journalist Rani Shaked, an expert on the Palestinian terrorist group Hamas, who writes for Yedioth Ahronot, an Israeli daily, has debunked the myth that it is only people with no means of improving their lot in life who turn to suicide terrorism. All leaders of Hamas, he told me, are university graduates, some with master's degrees. This is a movement not of poor, miserable people, but of highly educated people who are using the image of poverty to make the movement more powerful. Buses remain among the bombers' preferred targets. Winter and summer are the better seasons for bombing buses in Jerusalem, because the closed windows for heat or air conditioning intensify the force of the blast, maximizing the bomb's killing potential. As a hail of shrapnel pierces flesh and breaks bones, the shockwave tears lungs and crushes other internal organs. When the bus's fuel tank explodes, a fireball causes burns, and smoke inhalation causes respiratory damage. All this is a significant return on a relatively modest investment. 2 or 3 kilograms of explosive on a bus can kill as many people as 20 to 30 kilograms left on a street, or in a mall, or a restaurant. But as security on buses has improved, and passengers have become more alert, the bombers have been forced to seek other targets. The terrorists are lethally flexible and inventive. A person wearing a bomb is far more dangerous and far more difficult to defend against than a time device left to explode in a marketplace. This human weapon system can effect last-minute changes based on the ease of approach, the paucity or density of people, and the security measures in evidence. On a Thursday afternoon in March of last year, a reportedly smiling, self-satisfied bomber strolled down King George Street, in the heart of Jerusalem, looking for just the right target. He found it in a crowd of shoppers gathered in front of the trendy Aroma Cafe, near the corner of Agrippa Street. In a fusillade of nails and other bits of metal, 2 victims were killed, and 56 wounded. Similarly, in April of last year, a female suicide bomber tried to enter the Mahaniya Yud open-air market, the fourth woman to make such an attempt in 4 months, but was deterred by a strong police presence. So she simply walked up to a bus stop packed with shoppers hurrying home before the Sabbath and detonated her explosives, killing 6 and wounding 73. Suicide bombing initially seemed the desperate act of lone individuals, but it is not undertaken alone. Invariably, a terrorist organization such as Hamas, the Islamic Resistance Movement, the Palestine Islamic Jihad PIJ, or the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade has recruited the bomber, conducted reconnaissance, prepared the explosive device, and identified a target, explaining that if it turns out to be guarded or protected, any crowded place nearby will do. We hardly ever find that the suicide bomber came by himself, a police officer explained to me. There is always a handler. In fact, in some cases a handler has used a cell phone or other device to trigger the blast from a distance. A policeman told me there was one event where a suicide bomber had been told all he had to do was to carry the bomb and plant explosives in a certain place. But the bomb was remote control detonated. The organizations behind the Palestinian suicide terrorism have numerous components. Quartermasters obtain the explosives and the other materials, nuts, bolts, nails, and the like, that are combined to make a bomb. Now that bomb-making methods have been so widely disseminated throughout the West Bank and Gaza, a merely competent technician, rather than the skilled engineer once required, can build a bomb. Explosive material is packed in 2 pockets sewn into a canvas or denim belt or vest, and hooked up to a detonator, usually involving a simple hand-operated plunger. Before the operation is to be launched, minders sequester the bomber in a safe house, isolating him or her from family and friends, from all contact with the outside world during the final preparations for martyrdom. A film crew makes a martyrdom video, as much to help ensure that the bomber can't back out as for propaganda and recruitment purposes. Reconnaissance teams have already either scouted the target or received detailed information about it, which they pass on to the bomber's handlers. The job of the handlers, who are highly skilled at avoiding Israeli army checkpoints or police patrols, is to deliver the bomber as close to the target as possible. Talk to a senior police operations commander in his office at the Russian compound, the nerve center of law enforcement for Jerusalem, since the time when first the Turks and then the British ruled this part of the world. It was easy to imagine, amid the graceful arches and the traditional Jerusalem stone, an era when Jerusalem's law enforcement officers wore darbushes and pressed blue tunics with Sam Brown belts rather than the bland polyester uniforms and blue baseball-style caps of today. Although policing this multi-faith, historically beleaguered city has doubtless always involved difficult challenges, none can compare with the current situation. This year there were very many events, my host explained, using the bland generic noun that signifies terrorist attacks or attempted attacks. In previous years we considered 10 events as normal, now we are already at 43. He sighed. There were still 3 weeks to go before the end of the year. 19 of these events had been suicide bombings. In the calculus of terrorism, it doesn't get much better. How easy it has become for a person to wake up in the morning and go off and commit suicide, he observed. Once there were only bags on buses, not vests or belts to contend with, the policeman said. Everything is open now. The purpose is to prove that the police can do whatever they want, but it won't help. From the archives. Zion's Vital Signs, November 2001, A Journey Through Modern Israel, where terrorism has been a fact of ordinary life for decades, and where ordinary life defeats terrorism. By P.J. O'Rourke. This, of course, is the age-old strategy of terrorists everywhere to undermine public confidence in the ability of the authorities to protect and defend citizens, thereby creating a climate of fear and intimidation amenable to terrorist exploitation. In Jerusalem, and in Israel, as a whole, this strategy has not succeeded. But it has fundamentally changed daily behavior patterns, the first step toward crushing morale and breaking the will to resist. The terrorists appear to be deliberately homing in on the few remaining places where Israelis thought they could socialize in peace. An unprecedented string of attacks in the first 4 months of last year illustrated this careful strategy, beginning at bus stops and malls, and moving into more private realms, such as corner supermarkets and local coffee bars. In March, for example, no one paid much attention to a young man dressed like an ultra-Orthodox Jew, who was standing near some parked cars as guests left a bar mitzvah celebration at a social hall in the ultra-Orthodox Jerusalem neighborhood of Beit Israel. Then he blew himself up, killing 9 people, 8 of them children, and wounding 59. The tight-knit religious community had felt that it was protected by God, pointing to the miraculous lack of injury a year before when a booby-trapped car blew up in front of the same hall. Using a strategy Al-Qaeda has made familiar, the terrorists revisited the site. Less than a month after the Beit Israel attack, the suicide bombers and their leaders drove home the point that Israelis cannot feel safe anywhere by going to the one large Israeli city that had felt immune from the suspicion and antipathy prevalent elsewhere, Haifa, with its successful mixture of Jews, Christian, and Muslim Arabs, and followers of the Baha'i faith. The University of Haifa has long had the highest proportion of Arab students of any Israeli university. The nearby Matzah restaurant, owned by Jews, but run by an Israeli Arab family from Galilee, seemed to embody the unusually cordial relations that exist among the city's diverse communities. Matzah was popular with Jews and Arabs alike, and the presence of its Arab staff and patrons provided a feeling of safety from attack. That feeling was shattered at 2:30 on a quiet Sunday afternoon, when a suicide bomber killed 15 people and wounded nearly 50. As we had tea late one afternoon in the regal, though almost preternaturally quiet surroundings of Jerusalem's King David Hotel, Benny Morris, a professor of history at Ben-Gurion University, explained, "The Palestinians say they have found a strategic weapon, and suicide bombing is it. This hotel is empty. The streets are empty. They have effectively terrorized Israeli society. My wife won't use a bus anymore, only a taxi." It is undeniable that daily life in Jerusalem, and throughout Israel, has changed as a result of last year's wave of suicide bombings. Even the police have been affected. "I'm worried," one officer told me in an aside, whether in confidence or in embarrassment, I couldn't tell, as we walked past Zion Square, near where some bombs had exploded. "I tell you this as a police officer. I don't come to Jerusalem with my children anymore. I'd give back the settlements. I'd give over my bank account to live in peace." By any measure, 2002 was an astonishing year for Israel in terms of suicide bombings. An average of 5 attacks a month were made, nearly double the number during the first 15 months of the Second Intifada, and that number was itself more than 10 times the monthly average since 1993. Indeed, according to a database maintained by the National Security Studies Center at Haifa University, there were nearly as many suicide attacks in Israel last year, 59, as there had been in the previous 8 years combined, 62. In Jerusalem alone there were 9 suicide attacks during the first 4 months of 2002, killing 33 and injuring 464. "It was horrendous," a young professional woman living in the city told me. "No one went out for coffee. No one went out to restaurants. We went, as a group of people, to one another's houses only." Again, terrorism is meant to produce psychological effects that reach far beyond the immediate victims of the attack. The Scuds of Sodom in 1991 never caused as much psychological damage as the suicide bombers have, says Amy Paidazer, a professor of political science at Haifa University and an expert on political extremism and violence who manages the National Security Studies Center's terrorism database. As the French philosopher Gaston Boutoul argued 3 decades ago in a theoretical treatise on the subject, the anonymous, unidentifiable threat creates huge anxiety, and the terrorist tries to spread fear by contagion, to immobilize and subjugate those living under this threat. This is precisely what the Palestinian terrorist groups are trying to achieve. "The Israelis will fall to their knees," Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the spiritual leader of Hamas, said in 2001. "You can't sense the fear in Israel already. They are worried about where and when the next attacks will come. Ultimately, Hamas will win." The strategy of suicide terrorists is to make people paranoid and xenophobic, fearful of venturing beyond their homes even to a convenience store. Terrorists hope to compel the enemy society's acquiescence, if not outright surrender, to their demands. This is what Al-Qaeda hoped to achieve on 9/11 in one stunning blow, and what the Palestinians seek, as well, on a more sustained, if piecemeal, basis. After decades of struggle, the Palestinians are convinced that they have finally discovered Israel's Achilles heel. Ismail Haniyeh, another Hamas leader, was quoted in March of last year in the Washington Post as saying that Jews love life more than any other people, and they prefer not to die. In contrast, suicide terrorists are often said to have gone to their death smiling. An Israeli policeman told me, "A suicide bomber goes on a bus and finds himself face to face with victims, and he smiles, and he activates the bomb, but we learn that only by asking people afterwards who survived." This is what is known in the Shia Islamic tradition as the Basamat al-Farah, or smile of joy prompted by one's impending martyrdom. It is just as prevalent among Sunni terrorists. Indeed, the last will and testament of Muhammad Atta, the ringleader of the September 11th hijackers, and his primer 4 martyrs, "The sky smiles, my young son," clearly evidence a belief in the joy of death. This perceived weakness of an ostensibly powerful society has given rise to what is known in the Middle East as the spider web theory, which originated within Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shia organization, following a struggle that ultimately compelled the Israel Defense Forces to withdraw from southern Lebanon in May of 2000. The term is said to have been coined by Hezbollah Secretary General Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, who described Israel as a still formidable military power whose civil society had become materialistic and lazy, its citizens self-satisfied, comfortable, and pampered to the point where they had gone soft. IDF Chief of Staff Moshe Bugyalon paraphrased Nasrallah for the Israeli public in an interview published in the newspaper Haaretz last August. "The Israeli army is strong, Israel has technological superiority, and is said to have strategic capabilities, but its citizens are unwilling any longer to sacrifice lives in order to defend their national interests and national goals. Therefore, Israel is a spiderweb society. It looks strong from the outside, but touch it, and it will fall apart." Al-Qaeda, of course, has made a similar assessment of America's vulnerability. Society facing such a determined foe can respond. Israel, with its necessarily advanced military and intelligence capacities, was able in the first 4 months of last year to meet the most concerted effort to date by Palestinian terrorists to test the resolve of its government and the mettle of its citizens. 12 Israelis were killed in terrorist attacks in January 26, in February, 108 in March, and 41 in April. The population of the United States is roughly 47 times that of Israel, meaning that the American equivalent of the March figure would have exceeded 5,000 another 9/11, but with more than 2,000 additional deaths. After April of 2002, however, a period of relative quiet settled over Israel. The number of suicide attacks, according to the National Security Study Center, declined from 16 in March, to 6 in April, 6 in May, 5 in June, and 6 in July, before falling still further to 2 in August, and similarly small numbers for the remainder of the year. We wouldn't want it to be perceived by the Israeli population that we have no military answers, a senior IDF planner told me. The military answer was Operation Defensive Shield, which began in March and involved both the IDF's huge deployment of personnel to the West Bank and its continuing presence in all the major Palestinian population centers that Israel regards as wellsprings of the suicide campaign. This presence has involved aggressive military operations to preempt suicide bombing, along with curfews and other restrictions on the movement of residents. The success of the IDF strategy is utterly dependent on regularly acquiring intelligence and rapidly disseminating it to operational units that can take appropriate action. Thus, the IDF must continue to occupy the West Bank's major population centers so that Israeli intelligence agents can stay in close and relatively safe proximity to their information sources, and troops can act immediately, either to round up suspects or to rescue the agent should an operation go awry. Military pressure facilitates arrests, because you're there, one knowledgeable observer explained to me. Not only do you know the area, but you have covert spotters deployed, and the whole area is under curfew anyway, so it is difficult for terrorists to move about and hide without being noticed, and more difficult for them to get out. The IDF presence facilitates intelligence gathering, and the troops can also conduct massive sweeps, house to house and block to block, pick up people and interrogate them. The IDF units in West Bank cities and towns can amass detailed knowledge of a community, identifying terrorists and their sympathizers, tracking their movements and daily routines, and observing the people with whom they associate. Agents from Shabak, Israel's General Security Service, also known as the Shin Bet, work alongside these units, participating in operations and often assigning missions. The moment someone from Shabak comes with us, everything changes, a young soldier in an elite reconnaissance unit told me over coffee and cake in his mother's apartment. The Shabak guy talks in Arabic to the suspect without an accent, or appears as an Arab guy himself. Shabak already knows everything about them, and that is such a shock to them. So they are afraid, and they will tell Shabak everything. The success of Defensive Shield and the subsequent Operation Determined Way depends on the synchronization of intelligence and operations. A junior officer well acquainted with this environment says, whoever has better intelligence is the winner. The strategy, at least in the short run, is working. The dramatic decline in the number of suicide operations since last spring is proof enough. Tactically, we are doing everything we can, a senior officer involved in the framing of this policy told me, and we have managed to prevent 80% of all attempts. Another officer said, we are now bringing the war to them. We do it so that we fight the war in their homes rather than in our homes. We try to make certain that we fight on their ground, where we can have the maximum advantage. The goal of the IDF, though, is not simply to fight in a manner that plays to its strength. The goal is to actively shrink the time and space in which the suicide bombers and their operational commanders, logisticians, and handlers function, to stop them before they can cross the green line, by threatening their personal safety and putting them on the defensive. Citizens in Israel, as in America, have a fundamental expectation that their government and its military and security forces will protect and defend them. Soldiers are expected to die, if necessary, in order to discharge this responsibility. As one senior IDF commander put it, it is better for the IDF to bear the brunt of these attacks than Israeli civilians. The IDF is better prepared, protected, educated. Thus security in Israel means to the IDF and almost indefinite deployment in the West Bank, a state of ongoing low-level war. For Palestinian civilians it means no respite from roadblocks and identity checks, cordon and search operations, lightning snatch and grabs, bombing raids, helicopter strikes, ground attacks, and other countermeasures that have turned densely populated civilian areas into war zones. Many Israelis do not relish involvement in this protracted war of attrition, but even more of them accept that there is no alternative. Israel's ability to stand fast indefinitely is a tremendous advantage, says Dan Chuftan, an Israeli strategist and military thinker who teaches at Haifa University, since the suicide bombers believe that time is on their side. It imposes a strain on the army, yes, but this is what the army is for. Indeed, no Israeli with whom I spoke on this visit doubted that the IDF's continued heavy presence in the West Bank was directly responsible for the drop in the number of suicide bombings. And I encountered very few who favored withdrawing the IDF from the West Bank. This view cut across ideological and demographic lines. As we dined one evening at Matzah, which has been rebuilt, a centrist graduate student at Haifa University named Uzi Nazim told me that Palestinian terrorists will have the power to hit us, to hurt us, once the IDF withdraws from Jenin and elsewhere on the West Bank. Amy Paydazer of Haifa University, who is a leftist, agreed. He said, "There is widespread recognition in Israel that this is the only way to stop terrorism." I later heard the same thing from a South African couple, relatively new immigrants to Israel, who are active in a variety of human rights endeavors. Just the other day, the husband told me, "Even my wife said, 'Thank God we have Sharon. Otherwise I wouldn't feel safe going out.'" Nevertheless, few Israelis believe that the current situation will lead to any improvement in Israeli-Palestinian relations over the long run. Dennison, the defense correspondent for Israel's Channel 1, told me, "Yes, there is a drop-off in suicide bombings. When you have bombs coming down on your heads, you can't carry out planning and suicide attacks. But that doesn't take away their motivation. It only increases it." Ivan, the relative ease and the strategic and tactical attraction of suicide bombing. It is perhaps no wonder that after a five-day visit to Israel last fall, Louis Anemone, the security chief of the New York Metropolitan Transit Authority, concluded that New Yorkers, and, by implication, other Americans face the same threat. "This stuff is going to be imported over here," he declared, a prediction that Vice President Dick Cheney and FBI Director Robert Mueller had already made. In March, Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge also referred to the threat, saying in an interview with Fox News that we have to prepare for the inevitability of suicide bombings in the United States. Anemone even argued that today's terrorists appear to be using Israel as a testing ground to prepare for a sustained attack against the U.S. In fact, Palestinians had tried a suicide attack in New York 4 years before 9/11. Their plans to bomb a Brooklyn subway station were foiled only because an informant told the police. When they were arrested, the terrorists were probably less than a day away from attacking. According to law enforcement authorities, 5 bombs had been primed. "I wouldn't call them sophisticated," Howard Saffer, the commissioner of police at the time, commented, "but they certainly were very dangerous." That suicide bombers don't need to be sophisticated is precisely what makes them so dangerous. All that's required is a willingness to kill and a willingness to die. According to the RAND Corporation's Chronology of Worldwide Terrorism, which begins in 1968, the year acknowledged as marking the advent of modern international terrorism, whereby terrorists attack other countries or foreign targets in their own country, nearly two-thirds of the 144 suicide bombings recorded have occurred in the past 2 years. No society, least of all the United States, can regard itself as immune from this threat. Israeli Foreign Minister Benjamin Netanyahu emphasized this point when he addressed the U.S. Congress 9 days after 9/11. So did Dan Chuftan, the Israeli strategist, when I asked him if he thought suicide terrorism would come to America in a form similar to that seen in Israel this past year. He said, "It is an interesting comment that the terrorists make, We will finish defeating the Jews because they love life so much. Their goal is to bring misery and grief to people who have an arrogance of power. Who has this? The United States and Israel. Europe will suffer too. I don't think that it will happen in the U.S. on the magnitude we have seen it here, but I have no doubt that it will occur. We had the same discussion back in 1968 when LL aircraft were hijacked and people said this is your problem, not ours. The United States, of course, is not Israel. However much we may want to harden our hearts and our targets, the challenge goes far beyond fortifying a single national airline or corralling the enemy into a territory ringed by walls and barbed wire fences that can be intensively monitored by our armed forces. But we can take precautions based on Israel's experience and be confident that we are substantially reducing the threat of suicide terrorism here. The police, the military, and intelligence agencies can take steps that work from the outside in, beginning far in time and distance from a potential attack, and ending at the moment and the site of an actual attack. Although the importance of these steps widely recognized, they have been implemented only unevenly across the United States. Understand the terrorist operational environment. Know their modus operandi and targeting patterns. Suicide bombers are rarely lone outlaws. They are preceded by long logistical trails. Focus not just on suspected bombers, but on the infrastructure required to launch and sustain suicide bombing campaigns. This is the essential spadework. It will be for naught, however, if concerted efforts are not made to circulate this information quickly and systematically among federal, state, and local authorities. Develop strong, confidence-building ties with the communities from which terrorists are most likely to come, and mount communications campaigns to eradicate support from these communities. The most effective and useful intelligence comes from places where terrorists conceal themselves and seek to establish and hide their infrastructure. Law enforcement officers should actively encourage and cultivate cooperation in a non-threatening way. Encourage businesses from which terrorists can obtain bomb-making components to alert authorities if they notice large purchases of, for example, ammonium nitrate fertilizer, pipes, batteries, and wires, or chemicals commonly used to fabricate explosives. Information about customers who simply inquire about any of these materials can also be extremely useful to the police. Force terrorists to pay more attention to their own organizational security than to planning and carrying out attacks. The greatest benefit is in disrupting pre-attack operations. Given the highly fluid international threat the United States faces, counterterrorism units dedicated to identifying and targeting the intelligence gathering and reconnaissance activities of terrorist organizations should be established here within existing law enforcement agencies. These units should be especially aware of places where organizations frequently recruit new members, and the bombers themselves, such as community centers, social clubs, schools, and religious institutions. Make sure ordinary materials don't become shrapnel. Some steps to build up physical defenses were taken after 9/11, reinforcing park benches, erecting jersey barriers around vulnerable buildings, and the like. More are needed, such as ensuring that windows on buses and subway cars are shatterproof, and that seats and other accoutrements are not easily dislodged or splintered. Israel has had to learn to examine every element of its public infrastructure. Israeli buses and bus shelters are austere for a reason. Teach law enforcement personnel what to do at the moment of an attack or an attempt. Prevention comes first from the cop on the beat, who will be forced to make instant life and death decisions affecting those nearby. Rigorous training is needed for identifying a potential suicide bomber, confronting a suspect, and responding and securing the area around the attack site in the event of an explosion. Is the officer authorized to take action on sighting a suspected bomber, or must a supervisor or special unit be called first? Policies and procedures must be established. In the aftermath of a blast, the police must determine whether emergency medical crews and firefighters may enter the site, concerns about a follow-up attack and a date that first responders be held back until the area is secured. The ability to make such lightning determinations requires training and, tragically, experience. We can learn from foreign countries with long experience of suicide bombings, such as Israel and Sri Lanka, and also from our own responses in the past to other types of terrorist attacks. America's enemies are marshaling their resources to continue the struggle that crystallized on 9/11. Exactly what shape that struggle will take remains to be seen. But a recruitment video reportedly circulated by Al-Qaeda as recently as spring of last year may provide some important clues. The 7-minute tape, seized from an Al-Qaeda member by U.S. authorities, extols the virtues of martyrdom and solicits recruits to Osama bin Laden's cause. It depicts scenes of jihadists in combat, followed by the successive images of 27 martyrs, with their names, where they were from, and where they died. 12 of the martyrs are featured in a concluding segment with voiceover that says, "They rejoice in the bounty provided by Allah." And with regard to those left behind who have not yet joined them in their bliss, the martyrs glory in the fact that on them is no fear, nor have they cause to grieve. The video closes with a message of greeting from the Black Banner Center for Islamic Information. The greatest military onslaught in history against a terrorist group crushed the infrastructure of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, depriving it of training camps, operational bases, and command and control headquarters, killing and wounding many of its leaders and fighters, and dispersing the survivors. Yet this group still actively seeks to rally its forces and attract recruits. Ayman Zawahiri, bin Laden's chief lieutenant, laid out a list of terrorist principles in his book, Knights Under the Prophet's Banner 2001, prominent among them the need for Al-Qaeda to move the battle to the enemy's ground, to burn the hands of those who ignite fire in our countries. He also mentioned the need to concentrate on the method of martyrdom operations as the most successful way of inflicting damage against the opponent and the least costly to the mujahideen in terms of casualties. That martyrdom is highlighted in the recruitment video strongly suggests that suicide attacks will continue to be a primary instrument in Al-Qaeda's war against and perhaps in the United States. Suleiman Abu Ghaith, Al-Qaeda's chief spokesman, has said as much. In rhetoric disturbingly reminiscent of the way that Palestinian terrorists described their inevitable triumph over Israel, Abu Ghaith declared, "Those youths that destroyed Americans with their planes, they did a good deed. There are thousands more young followers who look forward to death, like Americans look forward to living."